when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is first to know the nature of things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain. I'm here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think I know.
And I want to thank that fellow down under.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
G'day and welcome to Democracy Sausage from the Australian National University. I'm Mark Kenny from the ANU's Australian Studies Institute, and I'm really excited and indeed honoured even to welcome to the barbecue someone I've long admired, both and known to some extent as well, but long admired his writings and seeing him as a commentator. You may have seen him yourself. He's an expert on both American and Australian politics, and that's a relative rarity. And he has a new book out called, very deliberately, Trump's Australia: How Trumpism Changed Australia and the Shocking Consequences for Us of a Second Term. Bruce Wolpe, welcome to the barbecue.
Yeah, it's absolutely so great to be here, Mark. We've known each other for a bit.
Yeah.
And when you were working at the Fairfax newspapers and then afterwards.
That's right. And you, of course, worked at Fairfax newspapers as well.
I worked at Fairfax newspapers, head of corporate affairs. So not on the journalism side, the business side.
Yeah.
But then when I moved to Julia Gillard's office when she was prime minister, you were covering her and the government. And
Still talking to me, which is
Some reporters who are just exceptional. David Crow, just excellent. Yourself, who you could talk, because what you're trying to do is trying to figure out why what was happening, and explain that to readers. There wasn't an angle. There wasn't an agenda. And so it was just great working with you.
And we
did some good things.
That's very kind of you to say so. I look back on that time. In fact, we were just discussing on the very last Democracy Sausage podcast last week with David Spears and Maria Taflaga. We were just sort of thinking back about Julia Gillard's time because, of course, the 10-year anniversary of her departure from that job
is like
just
now.
Passed. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
And so that had us reflecting not just about Gillard's time, but also about the extent to which Australia has changed as a result of that 10 years, not necessarily just as a result of her stewardship, but it was a pretty pivotal moment, particularly the way things concluded.
It was. Just one thing about being here on Democracy Sausage, it's such a great title. And there is I'm part of a conversation almost daily with several political scientists in the U.S., including E.J. Dionne, Norm Mann, Alan Abramowitz, Larry Sabato, and a couple others. And E.J. Dionne wrote a book, and it's relevant to this discussion, called 100% Democracy, which is, what are the best democracies in the world because of the way they vote? And Australia's compulsory voting came out as the gold standard for the world in E.J. Dionne's and Miles Rappaport co-wrote it. So when the election occurs here, Leslie and I always send them a photo of us having a democracy sausage after voting, and they love it. And
yes.
So I'm here in spirit and in culinary expertise.
And enthusiasm. yes, look, some Democracy Sausage listeners have probably heard me say this before, but we've had a number of international people on here over the 250 plus episodes we've done. And some of the people coming from abroad are less familiar with the tradition of the trestle table, a charity outside the polling booth where you can pick up a sausage and a bit of bread and some sauce.
Yes.
And they're assuming that the Democracy Sausage title comes from that old sort of possibly apocryphal Bismarckian analysis, which was about, voters don't want to see the sausage being made. They don't want to see the internal construction process. They just want to eat the sausage.
Right.
And in truth, it was a bit of, in my mind, it was that double entendre. I actually liked it because it sort of spoke to both of those things. So
it does.
So internationally, it works anyway, even if people don't know that we have compulsory voting and non-compulsory eating of sausages afterwards.
These guys are dying to come here and have a democracy sausage.
Well, good. And long may it continue because, as you say, it does celebrate a system that it may have its shortcomings. All systems do, as I think Winston Churchill pointed out, but it's better than all the rest.
Absolutely.
That's the truth of it, yeah. Now, look, let's go to your book, and I want to start where you do in your prologue because, I mean, for me, this is part of the honour of talking to you, right, is that you have such a unique and long history, which defies your youthful good looks, I might say. Because I was absolutely staggered to read this, but you start talking about growing up in D.C., in Washington, D.C., yes, which is interesting in itself because in Canberra, for example, increasingly now you meet people who are born here. But it used to be the case that they were relatively rare. Just about everyone was a kind of an expat from somewhere else.
Yep.
And the same when you meet people from America. It's a big country, lots of big cities, and you didn't tend to meet that many people. So you grew up there, and that's interesting in itself, but not only did you grow up there, but because of being an enthusiast as a kid and because of your parents and so forth, you actually remember some very key things. You were actually at the inauguration of John F. Kennedy as a child, presumably.
I was. It was a really cold day. It had snowed more than a foot, almost 2 feet the day before. People were wondering whether the inauguration, how it would come off. It was a bitterly cold day, but it was bright sunshine, and people might remember that Robert Frost could not read. He had to recite his inaugural poem from memory because the sun was glinting off his glasses and the page in front of him.
Right.
And but Kennedy, of course, youthful vigor, as they say in Boston.
Vigor.
Vigor.
Yeah.
Didn't wear a top coat and overcoat.
That's true.
So he was in, white formal dress.
And he ended up with a cold, didn't he, after that?
I don't think so. Well, president who got a cold and he actually died a few months later.
It was President Harrison. Right? Yes.
But anyway, it was just quite a day for a nine-year-old to see President Kennedy and to attend the parade. And he and Jackie came down Pennsylvania Avenue in the open car. Her pillbox hat, which became the fashion. My mother, and all the women in the neighborhood started wearing Jackie Kennedy's style clothes.
That's great history, yeah.
So it was part of it.
And the vision that we've all seen of him speaking at that time, and you could see the condensation, the clouds of mist coming from his breath as he spoke. I think there was a bit of a breeze there as well. You could see it was bitterly cold.
Yes. The speech was extremely powerful. We were in the middle of the Cold War. The U-2 had been shot down by the Russians. Eisenhower's last days were tense. Kennedy would ultimately face Khrushchev, and it was a terrible meeting, and it led to the Cuban Missile Crisis, which I also lived through as a student. We would huddle under glass under our desks waiting for a nuclear bomb to go off and everything. It's just part, you're closer to it. That's it. But Kennedy, in the inaugural address, if you read it, it's all about foreign policy. There's not a word of domestic policy in it. And so this is the post-Cold War, the post-war generation coming into the middle class and building the country at that time.
Yeah. And just to stay quickly, very briefly on this theme for a moment, because of where you were and that same time, you were then a couple of years later at Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech.
Yes.
At the Lincoln Monument.
I didn't go. White kids didn't go.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to use some language here. But I was in a summer camp.
I may have misread that.
I was in summer camp in West Virginia, and I heard the counselors talking, and they say the n****s are coming
for the march.
And that obviously stayed with me. So we were told to stay home. Our parents did not let us out of the house. None of the kids were out of the house because black people were marching downtown in Washington and at the Lincoln Memorial. But you still saw the power of that rally.
Yes, just astonishing. And you also take us then in that introduction, and this is shifting now to the subject of the book, Trump and all of that. And I want to read just so that listeners can have a sense of the sort of drama. I think it's a really, really great book you've written, and it really draws you in with that prologue. And in it, you come to the sort of moment of Trump, and in 2016. And you say, I never understood, still don't, how the United States could go from Barack Obama to Donald Trump, how the country could unite and conquer the legacy of race and send the first black American into the White House with an overwhelming margin, and yet 8 years later, elect a man who embodied the urge to divide America to its very core.
Yes. I still don't fully understand it. No, the only consolation I take from it is on the raw popular vote, Hillary Clinton won the election by 3 million.
Yeah.
If the Electoral College, which was set up by the founding fathers to be a buffer between the will of the people and responsible government, didn't exist, she would have been elected and we wouldn't have gone through this trauma. So it is an undemocratic institution. And other Electoral College, yeah. And other institutions have now been called into question because they're undemocratic too. The Senate, in which every state has two votes, so Wyoming has the same amount of votes as California. Mm. And because of the rigging of the rules, it requires 60 votes, a supermajority to pass anything. And you have a Supreme Court, which as we speak is at the lowest ebb of popularity in its history. 30% of the people approve of the court, 70% don't. So the court makes decisions on voting rights, on abortion rights, on gun control, none. And and people are rebelling. So the question posed by the 2016 election is, how do we make this democracy work in the context of a man who's very dangerous to that democracy itself?
Yeah, absolutely. Just before that, and speaking of the Obama part of it, you obviously were overjoyed. You're aligned with the Democrats. You've worked for the Democrats. You've worked for Labor here. You know, that's where you stand. I wonder, did it vex you that in order for one, for that breakthrough that you talk about there of sending a black man to the White House for the first time, that it came at the expense of the other breakthrough that was also needed that would have been remedied had Hillary won in 2016, had she won the college?
It's still worth having Obama as president.
Well, I wasn't really asking you that, but it is – you've worked for Australia's first female prime minister, so you're well aware –
It was worth having her too. They kind of suffered this – I mean, it's sort of the same fate. You have this breakthrough and then a retrograde reaction to it. And then you wonder, well, A, was it worth it? B, what's the legacy and where does it go? I think with the current government now, it seems that the energy wars are over because there's a pretty big consensus that we really have to do something serious. And the thought of more women taking power in the country is not scary to people anymore. So progress is being made.
Progress is being made, and you would have seen that because of the long life you've had and the country that you've seen that you grew up in and how it's moved to where it is now. But yes, it's also taken some backward steps, some dramatically backward steps in recent times. But, of course, also when you were a young man, Watergate happened, you know, 10 years after the inauguration, 11 years after that, Watergate happened.
It was shocking.
Yeah, and well, it's still the quintessential sort of political journalistic story, isn't it? It's certainly a byword for political corruption and conspiracy.
It was the epical story of a different time in a different era when things worked differently. Mm. It was a challenge to the Constitution itself. I mean, Nixon essentially was engaged in a conspiracy to corrupt the Democratic nominee and win the election. He carried out several things to do that. And he was at the center of it. But so Watergate was shocking. It was trauma. It was tense. It involved all three branches of government. But it led inevitably to a conclusion, which is he's got to go.
Yeah.
And the difference between then and now is you have almost the same thing playing out, an attack on various constitutional powers, an abuse of constitutional powers by the president. But the system does not deliver the same result. Mm. He not only survived the term, he's running again.
Yeah.
And Nixon famously said, so he resigns. He tries to come back later, and it's just said to him, there's no way that you're coming back to anything. Mm. So it's different.
It's different, right? But what's interesting about it, really fascinating about it, as I say, it's that kind of byword for these sorts of things. I asked James Clapper this at the National Press Club a few years ago, I mean, back during that time, back during Trump's first term, about some hacking of Democratic National Committee emails that you may recall that occurred. and some other things that were going on. And I said, you know, I explained that we often say in journalism, you know, don't worry, it's not Watergate. I said, what would you say about this? And he said, well, it's worse than Watergate. This is worse. And he then went through a number of reasons why it was. But I always think it's really interesting to compare these two, because Nixon was seen as, you know, corrupt, obviously, a venal, driven by hate, as you point out in your book.
Yes.
But at the same time, two critical differences distinguish them. And one is that in the end, the system works in ejecting Nixon. And the other is, and this is, these things are related, is that there is no Fox News. There is no sort of intensely partisan media. We don't live at that stage in the internet age. So describe to me how the media handled Watergate.
The media at that time, first of all the institutions of government and the media worked, and that led to the result of Nixon being forced out of office. At that time, there were three television networks, ABC, CBS, NBC. They still exist. A public television network was coming into its own. There was the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, Time Magazine, Newsweek Magazine, Life, and Look. That was kind
of
it.
And they didn't, and there was a whole lot of sort of regional, you know, regional other city papers, mastheads and stuff. But the point is they weren't all owned by one company. They didn't, you didn't tend to have cross-media ownership in the way that Australia pioneered disastrously.
And they were respected. So that when Walter Cronkite during the Vietnam War said, we are losing the Vietnam War, that is when people understood the Vietnam War had to come to an end. Mm. And when the reporting on Watergate was so strong and insistent that wrongdoing was done, most Americans believe that wrongdoing was done and that there needed to be accountability. With Trump, again, impeached twice. I mean, first of all, Nixon was not even impeached.
Yeah.
Clinton was the second president impeached, Trump the third and fourth. when Trump was impeached, he mounts a defense, and because of the explosion of media sources and the people not being not beholden to, but dominated by a cadre of mainstream media, everyone can reach their own conclusions about what, and they're
because there were papers of record, and media tended to towards factual reporting,
right?
And the weight.
Then there
of these
was opinion driven news coverage, in quotes, and Trump exploited that to the nth degree.
Yeah. So, just staying with Nixon, just for one more question.
Yes. I mean, he can never leave us.
But it's interesting because. There was a good side to him as well as a bad side. I mean, there were a couple of key moments that he did well. For example,
he established the Environmental Protection Agency.
Well, yes, I wasn't even going to mention that. I mean, that wasn't in my mind, but I was thinking that the 1960 election that he'd lost to JFK was incredibly close, wasn't there? There was an argument over how some votes had gone down in Chicago.
That's right.
He was under pressure to push for an inquiry, to have legal processes that would have dragged out the election result, and in the end, Nixon himself rejected that advice and said the country it's just not in the country's interest.
That's exactly right. And then so Trump in 2020 decides to contest the things that Nixon did not contest.
Yeah.
And he pushed it to the nth degree.
And he didn't even have any evidence.
He lost 60 court cases. He lost three times at the Supreme Court, and he had terrible lawyers.
Yeah. Yeah, because he had lickspittles, because the whole Trump administration was about sort of like cultish behavior, right? So you had these true believers.
That's right. And just jumping ahead in the narrative a little bit, that's a big lesson that he learned for the second term.
Yeah.
I'm not going to have anyone around me who's going to tell me about any guardrail that will keep me from achieving my objectives. Yeah. And I'm not going to hire someone who's going to say no to me. I'm only going to hire people who say yes to me.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what he's going to do.
Yeah. And that's what Nixon didn't do when it came to Watergate. So he's already done that. He eventually is president. And then when Watergate comes out, when that investigation brings him down, he doesn't do what we've seen Trump do now, and which populist autocrats are now doing and doing effectively. He didn't mobilize a huge section of the electorate in the way that Trump did to turn this into, so that every criticism that came toward him was badged as a sort of attack from the left.
And he didn't bar his counsel, John Dean, from going to the Senate and telling the Senate there's a cancer growing on the presidency, which blew it wide open. He didn't claim executive privilege over that.
Just stay with that for a moment. He didn't. So his aides
his lawyer, the White House counsel, goes to the Senate, unprotected.
Yeah.
He can say whatever he wants. Yeah. Nixon lets him do it.
And Nixon could, like Trump would have definitely claimed executive privilege.
Exactly.
At that point.
And no way that person would have appeared in a public hearing.
Yeah. And of course, in the end, it ends with him resigning. And Gerald Ford's first words are interesting, aren't they? You quote them in the book where you say, he says, "My fellow Americans," this is an amazing thing when you think about it. A Republican steps up to replace Nixon, and his first words are, "My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over.
That's right.
Our Constitution works. Our great Republic is a government of laws and not of men."
Yes. And it was a healing moment for the country. It was what the country needed to hear. But at the same time, it was the Republicans in the Senate who went to him and said, "The House is going to impeach you, and we are going to convict you." There's no Republican in the Senate, no critical mass of Republicans in the Senate who went to Trump and said, "We're going to convict you. You've got to go."
Yeah.
And so that's a profound change in the political culture from what it was 50 years ago.
Yes. All right. Well, look, let's take a quick break then. We'll come back, and I promise the listener we'll talk more about Trump himself. I know everyone loves talking about Trump, so we'll get back to
They still love Nixon too.
Oh, yes, that's right. Lovable old tricky dick. Okay, back in a moment.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. You're on Democracy Sausage. I'm talking with Bruce Wolpe, and we're talking about his new book, Trump's Australia. It's an absolutely galloping read and a worrying read, a very, very important, timely book, which I'd strongly recommend. So let's go now to the prospect of a Trump second term, which is essentially the warning, the fear of kind of the forms the spine of this book. The idea of a second term, I mean, some people may be tempted to think that, well, look, we survived, we being the civilized world or however you want to describe it, Americans, but also the rest of the world, you know, kind of survived the Trump first term. We can do so again for the second term. But you're arguing in this book that this is going to be an order of magnitude different for a variety of reasons. Speak to that.
It is. Trump as it will come back in a second term if he makes it. I think his chances of getting the nomination are slightly over 50%. His chances of election are slightly under 50%. So he's fully contestable, fully competitive.
That makes it dangerously palpable, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Over 50% for getting the GOP nomination. And do you put a lot of, in your bookmaking about that, are you considering the impact of his current legal difficulties with these documents?
Yes. I mean, what he's done, well, just briefly on that, he has a two-pronged argument, which is really powerful, and why he is able to defy gravity. Any other politician would be brought to earth, and that would be the end of it. Mm. Two things. He uses the word weaponization, something very popular in Canberra in recent times.
Yeah.
And he says, the attack on me is the weaponization by the deep state of the Justice Department. Mm. So a Democratic president has instructed his Democratic attorney general to mandate his Democratic Justice Department to indict me and take me down and drive me off the ballot. It is the biggest case of political interference in the nation's history.
Mm.
And so people have bought the weaponization by the deep state. So that captures all the candidates because they say, yeah, that's right. We support you, Donald, because you're saying that.
Mm.
But he says something very different, not very different, something that is exceptionally powerful with his base and, you know, why these voters are still on to him. He gave a couple speeches right after he was indicted, and I just want to read a couple words from what he said.
Yeah, do so, yeah.
He said, "In the end, they're not coming after me. They're coming after you."
Yeah.
I mean, that is one of the most potent formulations I can recall in modern political times.
Although for a billionaire to be saying it about blue-collar workers, it's a bit rich.
They vote for him. His biggest strength is non-college educated white men.
Yeah.
He says, so they're coming after you. Either we have a deep state or we have a democracy. Either the deep state destroys America or we destroy the deep state. And then he says, this is the final battle. I mean, this is almost biblical.
It is.
This is the final battle.
Apocalyptic.
With you at my side, we will demolish the deep state. And people go, they go nuts.
Yeah.
And if there was, I watched a focus group in Iowa, Republicans saying, and so when they're asked, should he be indicted? They're repeating these words. Mm. They're saying, this is why he's being indicted. We're with Donald.
Yeah. And you also make the point in the book that he's a strangely honest president.
Ruthlessly
in a way.
Honest.
Ruthless was the word. That's right. Ruthlessly honest president, in the sense that he there's no veneer, there's no subterfuge. He says he's going to do certain things, and then he goes on and does them, even though they're completely outrageous.
Yeah.
And so if we think about what you just read out there, the attack on the deep state, this is part of what would be a far less naive second presidency. He came in as someone who'd never held elected office. He didn't, as you make the point a number of times in the book, he didn't even know what he was dealing with. He didn't understand the presidency.
Exactly.
He didn't understand politics. He didn't understand Congress. All he saw were people trying to frustrate him as he sort of blundered around with his sort of ego trip. But this time, he understands a lot of those things, and he's going to be very
deliberate. And he
knows
how he's going to do it. So it's driven by two things. First, vengeance against all his enemies, and he wants to clean them out.
Yeah.
He has four major themes as president. He had them in the first term, and they're going to stay in the second, but he's going to know how to do it without any hesitation. He'll be ruthless about it. The first is America first, that he represents America first, and he wants whatever's good for the country, that's what he's for. Whatever's bad or takes away or diminishes the country, he's against. So it's always America
first. So this is protectionism and isolationism.
Those are the next two things. So
trade and
trade wars.
Yeah.
Isolationism, withdrawing from taking America, bringing American troops back, bringing America's influence back home, not participating in international organizations. I think the United Nations and NATO are number one and number two of what he wants to take apart.
Yeah.
International agreements like the World Health Organization.
Yeah.
The Iran nuclear deal, of course, was dead. The Paris Climate Agreement. So isolationism and then nativism, anti-immigration, build the wall, keep immigrants out. They're a threat to the country. So he will deploy all of his power in pursuit of those, and will put in place people who are 100% with him. He's not going, General Mark Milley is not going to be chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff under Donald Trump. Even Bill Barr, a rock solid Republican, he will not be attorney general. It's going to be people who will do his bidding completely.
Yeah, that's right. So he's, you know, you point out in the book the instability of the Trump administration, a lot of his cabinet ministers, senior staff, key position holders turning over quite regularly as they either resigned or he got rid of them.
Yes.
And some of them he attacked. I mean, I just found this astonishing. I don't know how many other people did, but from quite early on, he was publicly attacking some of his own people, even before he removed them.
Yes.
You know, pillaring their competence and their patriotism and so forth. It was a clown show.
We haven't seen anything like this. Yeah. But that's what we can say about Trump and so many of his activities. He fired the Secretary of State by tweet. I mean, please.
Yeah.
While he was sick and he was in a men's room in Africa.
Yeah,
I mean, it was just awful.
And it was presidency by Twitter to some extent, because this was the first time. If you think about it, I'm sure you've thought about this a lot, but you know, political messaging is usually a very conscious and deliberate process, right? There are a number of internal filters before things are said, particularly anything that goes out as a written statement. Trump short-circuited all of that. Suddenly, we had the midnight mind.
That's right.
of this vainglorious person.
That's
just
right.
Unfiltered.
Correct.
As he tweeted everything from abuse to covfefe or whatever it was.
Which happened to be early morning in Australia, so that the way the news cycle works,
yeah.
We wake up at 6 and 7 a.m. in the morning to get the news, and it's U.S. news. And it was, well, what did he say last night, and what did he tweet last night?
Yeah.
And so the anxiety levels rise because he's pushing buttons on issues that are really important to Australians.
Yeah.
Immigration, racial issues, international issues.
International. I mean, he would attack other world leaders or sort of, you know,
that's right.
Say dismissive things about their competence.
Which the Australian government, and at the time, you know, a conservative government here, the coalition, did not have any interest in rubbishing NATO or rubbishing the leaders of other countries, the Prime Minister of Canada or the President of Mexico.
Mm.
So, yeah, Australia was, you know, then you have to manage that.
Yeah.
But the next time it's going to go deeper.
Yeah, that's right. So What are the kinds of things, like looking at it from Australia's point of view, that we need to worry about here? For a start, I mean, obviously there's a different colour of different flavour of government here, brand
yes.
of government here than was the case when Trump was there. Trump yes. got on well with Morrison in the end.
Yes.
How would he relate?
Let's start with our neighbourhood because that's closest to us. And yeah. I think so the foreign policy and trade issues are really important. So what is Trump really going to do in the Asia-Pacific, Indo-Pacific? And that so the heart of that, aside from what to do with the alliance with Australia, is China. He obviously wants to renew and forge a new working relationship with President Xi. So what happens in that? And what happens with all the collateral architecture around that, like AUKUS and ASEAN and stuff like yeah. that? I think Trump and the trade issues are involved. So I think Trump wants to have the best trade deal for the United States possible with China. And then the question is, at what expense is that transactional deliverable made? And that brings up Taiwan. And what is Taiwan part of the price of that trade deal? It also brings up AUKUS. I mean, if she says, I also want to do the best trade deal with you, but this AUKUS is a real annoyance to me. Can we just play that down a little bit? And Taiwan, I want your understanding that, I want your assurance that there are no issues with us taking over Taiwan. And I think that's a deal that Trump could make. The point is not necessarily
well,
that
as a nationalist, when we've seen this anyway, haven't yeah. we? The way he respects autocrats and nationalists
power.
Around the world.
That's right.
He sees the world like they see the world.
That's right.
Even though he sits atop a notionally democratic country. And so when they say, when Xi Jinping says to him, Taiwan has always been part of Greater China, a lot of countries don't even recognize it. Very few countries recognize it as a separate country. We will reincorporate that territory. That's yeah. our plan. We've been very open about it. And yeah. Trump would think, well, I'm not going to shed American blood and treasure for over that. I'll do this deal instead.
Trump is absolutely against foreign engagement. I mean, the end of the war in Afghanistan, as horrific as it was, he engineered the agreement that did that.
Mm.
And he was within an hour, minutes of signing a piece of paper on his desk to withdraw all troops from South Korea. So I think he wants to do that. I think it was John Kelly, the chief of staff, who pulled that piece of paper away and it disappeared and he never signed it.
I mean, that would have been a major moment.
But those major moments like that are coming. I think he'll say to Japan, oh, you like all the American troops we have there? Well, you're not paying enough for it.
Yeah.
And he may say the same for Australia. So yeah. there's going to be a whole bunch of collateral stuff up. But the point of the book is, I don't know, and there are others more expert than me who can say, well, this is more likely. Fine. Let's start thinking about what we do under various scenarios. Because what I really hope is that 2024 is a year of being proactive instead of 2025 by Australia, instead of 2025 being a year where Australia is reactive.
Yeah, as in hasn't really thought about
hasn't
this
thought
coming.
About it. And you were hit with things. Oh, surprise.
Yeah. yeah.
What do we do now? You know, the first crisis with Trump in his term with Malcolm Turnbull was over an immigration deal.
Mm.
Well,
we saw the
immigration rhetoric.
Yeah,
I guess,
and the incredulity, the sort of naivety that he had about this, he just couldn't understand it. And eventually, he said those words to Malcolm Turnbull: "You're worse than we are."
That's right.
Said it with admiration.
That's right.
It
shocked Australia, but no one had done thinking. Well, what if this guy is really serious about his rhetoric and he decides to cancel that agreement? What do we do?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So, and it's interesting that when we think about AUKUS, right, because the framing of the sort of friction about AUKUS in Australia mostly comes from the left.
That's right.
But in fact, it may be that a right-wing sort of almost madman, if we can describe him as that, running America, just pulls AUKUS anyway. I mean, he's going to say, why would we be giving you our
Virginia-class
submarines?
He's transactional.
Yeah.
And I think he will look at AUKUS and say, where are those contracts going? Who's benefiting more? Where are the profits being made? Why can't we do it? There's just a couple words on what I interviewed about 2 dozen former officials. I find them speaking more honestly than current serving officials.
Yes, about I found that too. Yeah.
And their expertise is really great. So they said, you know, what do you think about Trump as you go into this? They say he'll never change. He's erratic. He's unhinged. He has chaos. He's arrogant. He has no sense of history. He doesn't care about what happened yesterday. If he's doing it, it's happening for the first time. He's completely transactional. That's where AUKUS comes in. He's unpredictable. Suddenly we can be surprised with something that no one really.
Mm.
And then he never apologizes. He never says he was wrong. He never recants. He never retreats.
Yeah.
And so that's the mindset coming on these foreign policy issues.
Yeah. Now, let's talk about something I've written a little bit about and we've spoken before about Trumpism as a sort of a political methodology, as praxis almost, the way politicians, particularly on the right, outside of the US, have adopted some of these same strategies. I mean, partly driven by, facilitated by the digital age and so forth.
Yes.
But we've seen some of this in Australia as well, haven't we?
Yes, we
in
have.
A number of different ways. You know, sort of the sort of reflex to maximum division all the time. Don't ever reach agreement on anything.
There's that, although that's inherent in the Westminster system, where oppositions oppose completely and governments try to govern. But the divisiveness of pushing those buttons is there. And so with those 7 a.m. and 6 a.m. news bulletins, what we have here is an echo chamber of what's coming across from Trump and the United States. Mm. And so when you have Nazis marching in the streets of Charlottesville, Virginia, well, Nazis show up outside Parliament House in Victoria,
in Melbourne.
And at the height of the pandemic, you have people carrying a gallows on a cart through the streets of Melbourne. And there's gallows on a cart outside the Capitol on January 6th to hang Mike Pence.
Mm.
So that's the echo chamber.
And so it has its popular dimensions, but it also has its puppet masters, or people who want to take advantage of it.
That's right.
I mean, think about the revelation that Morrison had signed himself into all these ministries secretly and breached the sort of very basis of Westminster accountability.
Yes,
that party has not apologized for that.
Morrison
still sits in the parliament.
I thought that was really an important moment in this country's political culture, where you had such a violation of Westminster norms. It was just finally disclosed after the fact. He was held accountable. He was censured by the parliament. I believe he was the first prime minister, former prime minister, to have been censured by parliament.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah,
and he was held accountable, but not held accountable by his party.
No.
And so you have in the Liberal Party, at least on that instance, something very similar to what happened in the Republican Party, where the Republicans keep voting in the Congress. They didn't convict Trump of impeachment. But there is a difference.
Some of the same people who are huddling behind tables when the January 6th riot occurred.
Yes, but there is a difference. The extremism of Trumpism in America, so it goes to guns, it goes to abortion, it goes to religious values and so forth, they're not reflected here. Transgender issues. So extremist liberal candidates in the last elections lost. And I saw that as a very encouraging sign of where this country is centered. And part of the reason why it's centered is because we have compulsory voting. And
compulsory
we have that 100%.
Preferential voting, yeah.
And that means extremists don't win elections. You're going to land center left or center right all the time. Now, the centers will shift a little bit. Howard was a very conservative prime minister, but it was within the bounds.
So what you're saying there is the system requires you in a compulsory preferential system to build a constituency sort of across the center,
at
least reaching into that center ground,
whereas
the American system, where it's not direct, as you said before, but also it's not compulsory, and it's about revving up your base.
Exactly, and the Trump base is going to vote. So it does make a huge difference in outcomes, and I think it's just so important.
Yes. Now, one of those former intelligence officers that you interviewed made the point that this is an ex-intelligence official, I think, who said it's not just Trump that we need to worry about. It's the GOP, because they are the ones who are electing him, and that this is not well understood in Australia.
That's right. And the way to stop Trumpism, political parties want to win. The way to stop Trumpism is for them to lose successive elections, and then those ideological issues are washed out of the system.
Yeah. And Trump's lost a few, but when he's
not enough. It's interesting. Ron DeSantis, governor of Florida, his most potent competitor, says we have to get rid of our losing culture. Well, what's our losing culture? He lost the House of Representatives. He won the election, but he didn't get 50% of the
vote. Exactly, so he didn't really win it.
He lost the House of Representatives in 2018. He lost the presidency in 2020. He lost the Senate in 2022. How many times are we going to keep doing this to ourselves? So
as you say, he loses elections that he's not in himself.
That's right.
And he's had a record.
But you have leaders in order to win elections. Well, the Liberal leader here lost the seat of Aston.
Yeah.
And it dented his standing.
Yeah.
So, it does ultimately flow to the top.
Or in 2007, the Liberal leader who was the prime minister lost his seat.
Yes.
Yeah.
One other guardrail that's really important here. So we talked about compulsory voting, but we have the Westminster system.
Mm.
we can't have a Trump prime minister in that we can't have a blow-in cannot become prime minister like a blow-in like Trump can become president.
Yeah.
It has to be the leader of the majority party and the reps.
Yeah.
And the cabinet comes from parliament too.
Mm.
So this means that the person so Clive Palmer can never be prime minister. Pauline Hanson,
even though he actually ran on some ludicrous
claim with $100 million,
so, yeah.
He cannot be prime minister. Pauline Hanson cannot be prime minister. Tweaky Forrest cannot be prime minister.
Mm.
So the prime ministership is going to be held by someone who's imbued with the Westminster culture,
yeah.
And that is a guardrail on democracy here.
Yeah. Now, just in the time we've got left, let's think about. A live situation that we have at the moment, we can, I guess, look at this from two dimensions. I'm talking about Ukraine.
Yes.
If Ukraine had happened and Trump was still there, had he won the election that Biden won, then Ukraine, the invasion of Ukraine would have happened on Trump's watch.
Yes.
That's assuming it would have happened.
Yes.
He says it wouldn't have happened.
I don't think it would have happened because, I think Ukraine would have... No, Ukraine didn't have to happen because what Trump was going to do was destroy NATO. That was the issue, not the land of Ukraine. After NATO's destroyed, then Ukraine is another issue.
Mm.
Putin wanted NATO destroyed. Mm. Trump wanted to destroy NATO. Mm. So no, there would have been no invasion of Ukraine.
Now that we have an invasion of Ukraine and the potential for Trump to come back for a second term, and presuming that it's not going to be resolved before then, he says he can resolve it in 24 hours, presumably just by complete capitulation.
Yes, I think that phone call, he says, I can solve it in 24 hours. I think that phone call is very simple. Vladimir, yes. Ukraine is yours.
Yes. Now,
why am I laughing? I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, I guess that's all you can do, really. But it's, if we think about that, for example, that goes to the point you were making before about how Australia has to look at where it is positioned
that's
internationally,
right.
Because Australia has a very strong principled position on Ukraine, as do most Western countries, and could find itself on an opposition ticket to.
This brings us to our Simon Crean moment in this discussion.
Yes,
Because of Simon's passing, which was so sad.
Yes.
His life is being recalled, and the moment that everyone is looking back at is when he said he was against the Iraq War, and he farewelled the troops and said, "You should not have to go. You should not be going. Mm. But we support you, and we want you to return safe." That was one hell of a moment.
It was, and that took real courage.
That took real courage. Yeah. So. If Trump does this stuff, this what we're talking about, yes, a prime minister can stand up and say, we do not agree with the United States and we're not going to go down that road. And we are for NATO, we are for Ukraine, we're against Russia, and we want a world of stability, order, peace, and prosperity. But in 2003, too many people were too afraid to say that. We can say that. This country can say that under Trump.
Yes, absolutely. Bruce, it's been an absolute pleasure having you talking about this book, Trump's Australia. It's, in a sense, worrying material, but like you say, we need to be thinking about this, and we need to be thinking about it in terms of a Trump second term that would be significantly more dangerous and have greater implications for Australia than was the case the first time around. And if we thought that was bad, it was bad, but it was also, it was falling over itself a lot of the time. It was sort of chaotic and Trump didn't know what he was doing.
People are thinking about it. They come up to me and they say, it really could happen again, couldn't it? So the anxiety level here is rising, and I think that's a healthy thing.
Yeah. Well, look, just before you go, it would be remiss of me not to raise this with you, given your expertise in this area. Is it wise for the Democrats to be running an 81-year-old someone who would be 81 at the time of inauguration, should he win the next election, that being Joe Biden?
There's the answer
that
to that question.
Risky to me.
It is. What's interesting is with both candidates, you have more than half the country saying they don't want either of them.
Yeah.
So normally you say, "Oh yeah, I'm for Obama." You know.
Yeah.
I'm for Dick.
Yeah.
But here, no. And the reason why Biden is unchallenged goes back to the 1980 presidential election, which was something that is now in the DNA of Democrats yet to be born, which is who live now and are yet to be born, which is Jimmy Carter presided over an economy of roaring inflation, high interest rates, and a foreign policy crisis in Iran, the hostages, and it was humiliating to the United States. Ted Kennedy, the last surviving brother, decided to enter the race and run against him, and he got the emotions high and so forth. Carter held on. But the price of holding on was He lost in the general election to Ronald Reagan by a landslide, and Reagan served 8 years. That's why Joe Biden is not being challenged. And so Democrats have to live with that and have to figure out how to win with that.
And you mentioned before about how the differences in our political system with our governments drawn from the legislature and the prime minister and so forth being, you know, having to have the numbers in a party that has the majority and so forth. The American system has like a vacuum in those regards, right?
Completely.
So is there anyone other than Biden in your mind that like, let's assume for a moment
yes.
that one of the risks with Biden is just simply his age, right? And
it
that
is.
He suddenly is unable to go forward as the candidate. Who else would step up?
Let's play out the scenario. If he, let's say he became unwell and could not finish the first term, I believe he would step aside, and I believe his family would understand that he needs to step aside.
Yeah.
Okay, so he steps aside.
And that would be Kamala Harris.
Kamala Harris becomes president. She has the chance to appoint a vice president to be confirmed by the Senate under the constitutional arrangements following Kennedy's assassination. So there could be a Kamala Harris vice president. But immediately that would open the field and you would have a norm. It would look like 2020 all over again with candidates running.
Right.
And I think the two strongest candidates are Gretchen Whitmer, the governor of Michigan, who, by the way, was almost victim of something that ended up in the Capitol insurrection. Do you remember men with long rifles going to the Capitol in Michigan and surrounding it and trying to get into
yes.
the chamber?
Yes.
That was her.
Wow.
I think she's very impressive. And Gavin Newsom, the governor of California.
Right.
Any governor of California, you got to pay attention to.
Yeah.
So it would be an open primary. And they would run against Kamala Harris. And so that would be an open, you know, primary, and you just see where it lands. Kamala Harris does represent the aspirations of Black voters. And that's why Biden, first of all, Biden has complete faith in her and confidence and wants her and so forth. But if he was pressured to get rid of her, then that would be – the Black vote would disappear. It would be a real wound.
It's going to be fascinating to watch this as it always
it
is.
Will.
The world's eyes on it. More important than ever, perhaps.
No shortage of material.
No, that's right. Bruce Wolpe, thanks so much for coming to Democracy Sausage at ANU. It's been a real pleasure to have this discussion.
It's been wonderful
to
talk with you. Thank you so much. Thanks for all your support for this book.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. And that's Democracy Sausage for this week. We'll talk to you again next week. Until then, bye for now.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.